Well, hello again, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Two Ways News. As usual, it's me, Tony Payne, and over there...
It's Philip Jensen.
Yeah, it's good to be with you again. And Philip, good to be with you too.
Yes, I've been watching lots of Olympics, so I'm not sure where my mind is at the moment.
I hope you haven't been staying up. It's not ideally timed for the Australian viewing audience, is it?
It's very unhelpful.
Oh, I was very disappointed. I fell asleep watching the last round of the golf, which of course was the most important and wonderful event of the Olympics so far, that extraordinary final round. But I fell asleep and I couldn't find a replay the next morning. So it was terrible.
If you go, there's a particular streaming service, which I won't mention because they're not paying us anything.
Oh, okay.
But there's one that has everything and replays of everything.
Oh, okay. Well, I need to find that. That's what I need to find. You can tell me later.
Or you can get the free one for a week to try it out.
and that's the one. Oh, I see. So what have you been thinking about watching the Olympics? Which things have you been enjoying?
Oh, any competition. I like watching the unusual ones. So in winter, I always like watching curling because you don't see it at any other time.
Oh, the luge. I love watching the luge
is fun.
In the winter.
But this summer, I watched them climbing walls yesterday.
Oh, right.
Racing up the wall.
The things they have in the Olympics these days.
Yes, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah.
I watched a little bit of the skateboards.
Right.
But I think you have to be 14 or 15 to be able to
do what they do. It's quite extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. But I saw the final of the tennis. The doubles was fantastic because the men who won it, they're in their mid-30s and they had their children in the crowd. And the connection with their children afterwards, and one man throwing his child up into the air, I tell you, if he dropped it, the media would never have forgiven him. But the little child so enjoyed being thrown up into the air by the father. It was delightful to see.
It's hard not to, for me anyway, I always associate the Olympics with Chariots of Fire. I always think about Chariots of Fire and the music, boom, 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 and then that opening scene where they're running through the surf. And
it's a brilliant scene, and the music has stood the test of time in terms of people's... If you don't know the film, you'll still know the music.
We'll see if we can find a clip of the music for you to illustrate, yes.
That might be better than your singing, yes.
It's a hard one to sing, that one. I could sing the hymn that the movie starts with, of course, which is Jerusalem, which is a very clever way to start the film.
It is clever, but it's funny, isn't it, because it's the funeral of a Jewish man.
Yeah.
That's because later on he came to embrace Christianity formally, culturally, which is kind of strange because the movie centres on the contrast between the two characters, the Jewish man from England and the keen Christian, the evangelical missionary Christian from Scotland, Eric Liddell. But in fact, the Jewish man's Jewishness, he was an Englishman.
He was an Englishman, yes. I am an Englishman, as he sang, so from the Gilbert and Sullivan episode in the course of the film. And it was about Englishness and Christianity and Jewishness and the intersection or the conflict between those things, of course. It's just astonishing to me to think that movie was released in 1981. It's not possible, surely, but it was. It was 1981.
But it holds up very well, unlike some movies. You can watch it now and it's still a great... I mean, it won Academy Awards and the rest of the time, didn't it? But it's a great movie. It's well done.
And I remember watching it at the time as a Christian and it being one of those very few movies at that time in Western culture in which Christianity was presented in a not unsympathetic fashion, if I can put it that way, in which the Christian man in the film was, in a sense, the hero of the film.
Yes, in some ways more than the Jewish man who was semi-professionalised. It's kind of funny to think of the Olympics as being amateur these days. The hero is the Christian man whose conscience won't let him run on a Sunday, and his willingness... his boldness to follow his conscience on not being involved in the sport on Sunday, even though it was his specialised race that he was supposed to enter into. And you don't get many Christian conscience movies. You say back then, I don't think you get many today either.
That's right, even less so perhaps.
Even though the Christians have stood for conscience on a whole range of issues, this is one episode. I call it a story, but it's history. One episode of one man who did it in a most extraordinary fashion.
It was very interesting to me, the portrayal of Christianity in that film. At one level, he was portrayed as a very admirable and consistent man, But there was also this stream within the film, and I don't know how accurate this is historically, because I haven't delved into the details of it, but it certainly suited the rhetoric of the film very well, while being in one sense positive about this man's Christian conviction and conscience and his sort of courage and so on. There was also this kind of knock against a sort of legalistic, moralistic, killjoy form of Christianity that was represented in his sister Jenny, who was always terribly worried about him running and how running was somehow not what God would have wanted him to do, or somehow he was wasting his gifts and wasting God's purpose in his life by doing all this running.
You can't expect historical films to be historically accurate. It's like asking people who tell stories to get every detail accurate. They're bad storytellers. You know, you mustn't let the facts get in the way of the story, the point of the story.
The truth of a story, even if every detail is not precise, yes.
But Hollywood saw that they needed to increase the drama level. And so, with her permission, I understand, they made his sister Jenny as this kind of legalistic...
The foil,
which in some ways damaged her life for the rest of her life, because it was not even vaguely true. In fact, she wasn't in Scotland at the time. She was in China.
As a missionary.
As a child. She was much younger than he was. And so she was with her parents in China. And she didn't have this attitude of negativity towards his sporting life in the least. But nobody would believe that in her older life. Everybody saw her in the movie as being the truth rather than her as the person. I think that's very sad. You know, I mean, if the person is from a different century and they're dead, well, they don't have to suffer the misrepresentation. But a person who's still alive, a misrepresentation is very painful. So that's a sad feature of it. I don't know all the details, but I've read several articles on that about her.
And
I feel sadly for her because she's a very lovely Christian woman, as best I could see.
And you wonder too, I mean, the conversations and the dialogue that happens, obviously they're fictionalised, they're sort of dramatising what's happened. And the famous scene where Liddell has declared to the Olympic chiefs that he's not going to run in the final on Sunday, and they're desperately trying to persuade him to run. The scene where they wheel in the Prince of Wales.
Yeah, it's just wonderful. You've got to know who the Prince of Wales is at that point, don't you?
Well, you're older than me, Philip. You need to tell everyone who the Prince of Wales was at that time.
Remember him well, one could say. Well, it was the man. I mean, he is really saying to Liddell, you've got to put king and country first.
Yes, above yourself.
Yes, and some of the people in that scene above God as well. The Prince of Wales at that time is the future King Edward VIII, who did not put king and country ahead of his own personal desires.
Not in the least.
For the sake of an adulterous divorcee marriage, he renounced the crown and turned his country into chaos. And so the irony of him, of all people, trying to argue for principles is just... It's hilarious, sad, funny, all at the same time, isn't it? But I suspect most people today wouldn't know who he was. You've got to know who the Prince of Wales was in 1924.
And who he would become.
And who he would become to get the point that's being made.
Which I think the filmmakers were making.
I'm sure they were making it. Whether it actually happened or not, I have no idea. But I'm sure they'll make it. And in 1981, I think the crowd still remembered who he was. But by 2024, that's unlikely.
It raises all sorts of fascinating questions, the film, and it's a nice sort of bounce off for our conversation today, because it raises the question of conscience and Sabbath in particular, and that's been an issue that Christians have kind of disagreed about, not only among themselves, but especially with the culture at large, about how the question of Sunday or of a communal day off or of the nature of Sabbath and the Lord's Day, how these things not only should they function within the Christian community, but how as a nation and as a culture we should deal with Sabbath, with Lord's Day. It interestingly kind of raises those questions by looking back at an earlier era in which that all made quite some sense as a legitimate field of conscience for somebody. Today we look back at it now and we think that that'd be very strange for somebody to refuse to play on a Sunday.
Yes, it was. But it was, well, the movie and the event that the movie is presenting happened and was right to happen. But the same man, when he was a prisoner of war in the Japanese in China, he organised Sunday sport for the children in the camp. Now, I don't think he gave up his principles in the slightest. I think the principles of the Sabbath are just a little bit more complicated than Hollywood is going to present. And how to understand what it's about. You see, we believe in the Ten Commandments. And dear listeners, Tony and I have been working on a book on the Ten Commandments, which we hope will come out next year. It's off with the editors to do their worst on us. And we struggled with this chapter on the commandment of the Sabbath, because as Christians, we're committed to keeping the Ten Commandments. But what does that mean about keeping the Sabbath day? Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. How do Christians keep the Sabbath is a very serious and difficult question for us.
And historically, we've come up as Christians with different answers to that question. Even within Protestant Reformed Evangelical Christianity, there are different views about the importance of the Lord's Day. And there's a stream of more Sabbatarian way of thinking that thinks that Sunday as the Lord's Day has become a kind of Christian Sabbath, a replacement of that Sabbath. And so we keep the Ten Commandments by treating Sunday somewhat as Israel was required to treat it Saturday. There's that stream of thinking, all the way through to, no, there's no Sabbath, all days are alike, it doesn't apply at all, and kind of everywhere in between.
Yes, it's also caught up with, and why you and I have been working on this book, is what is the place of the law?
Yes.
What is the place of the Ten Commandments in the Christian life? Because a couple of things have actually diminished the Ten Commandments in our Christian community here in Sydney. I've used that word community again, which we mentioned last week we shouldn't be using. But amongst the Christians in Sydney, shall I say, one is the great emphasis on grace, which I wouldn't want to downplay in the slightest, and how we're saved by faith, not by works, that is, faith in Jesus, not works of the law. Well, then, do we still have the law? Should we be obeying the law? How can we? And so the replacement of the Ten Commandments with the great summary that Jesus gave of love God, love your neighbour. But Jesus doesn't give that as a replacement for the Ten Commandments. He gives that as a summary of the commandments.
As a set of, as two foundational principles on which they all hang.
Yes, and without hearing the Ten Commandments, I think love God and love your neighbour can be a slightly empty of content. What will it mean to love my neighbour? And so we've got this diminution of the Ten Commandments in the Christian life, replaced, of course, in the public through the Roman Catholic idea of the seven deadly sins. That's now a replacement. But the Ten Commandments in previous generations in Reformed Christian Bible-believing people have been fundamental. In fact, most of our churches had the Ten Commandments written on the walls in front of us. And the prayer book, you said the Ten Commandments every communion service, in full, one by one. And so,
and with a response from the congregation, something like, incline our hearts
to keep this, law. Yes, and write all these thy laws in our hearts by the Holy Spirit. So what is it about the Ten Commandments? What about the Sabbath one? I mean, some of them are straightforward. Don't commit adultery.
But that seems pretty applicable. I can cope with that.
Do not steal. I mean, you know, but remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Well, what am I doing and how do I do that? It seems to me, you know, we could discuss which day, but I don't think which day is the key of the commandment. It doesn't mention which day. It just remembers the Sabbath day. You can say, well, you count back to the creation and it's the seventh day of creation. Unfortunately, we don't know that accurately. We could know when that was. And so it's remember the rest day to keep it separate, to be holy. Which day, I don't think, is what the point is. You do it because God has created the world this way. So that's one reason. And you do it communally. Come back to the communal one in a moment or two. The creation is the basis for the Sabbath commandment. Because God has created the world in 6 days and rested. God set up the pattern of work and rest, the differentiation between work and rest. And he sees it within the creation itself. And so for Israel, keeping the Sabbath was a sign, a covenant sign of being Yahweh's people. Because Yahweh is the creator of the universe in 6 days who rested. And so as Yahweh's people, we must work and rest. That's part of, because Christians, we're in a different kind of phase, aren't we?
Well, and in one sense we are. We still live in the creation that Yahweh made.
And so we still need rest.
Yes.
And the, what do they call it, the work?
Work-life balance.
The work-life balance is one of the ongoing problems of the 21st century in Western society, because we've ignored the concept of the rest, and you can't actually work all the time.
I'm thinking we should, you're obviously referring, like the Ten Commandments come in two places in the Old Testament, in Exodus and in Deuteronomy, and you're reflecting the Exodus one there and what you're saying about it being anchored in creation. I probably should read those verses. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. This is Exodus 20, verse 8. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy.
Now, the parallel, though, in Deuteronomy 5 is slightly different, isn't it?
It is. So this one very much emphasises a creational pattern that they were to reflect in their own social arrangements. And in that sense, as we look back at law and at laws like this and see what do they teach us about our lives and the world, there's something very obvious there. But the one in Deuteronomy, as you say, is a little different.
So why don't you read that one for us?
It reads like this in Deuteronomy 5. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as the Lord, as Yahweh your God, commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your ox or your donkey or any of your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates, that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God, again, that's Yahweh your God, commanded you to keep the Sabbath day.
Now, the male servant is the same word as the word slave. There's no great differentiation. It's a stylistic differentiation at that point. But one of the things that's striking about it is the communal nature of the rest day. And that seems to be an important part when we come to apply it across into the New Testament. That this is addressed not to every individual, this is addressed to the heads of households. You are to keep it, and you're to keep it in such a way that your household can keep it. Every part of your household, down to the animals of your household, but certainly your slaves and your servants are to keep it. And so we assume that the commandments are addressed to the individual, but they're actually addressed to the community at this point, to the household community, to the household leader, that he has a responsibility to make sure that not only he remembers God and the rest day by taking a day off, but he must make sure that everybody else enjoys this benefit, especially remembering that you were slaves, so you know what it was like when you're in Egypt and you didn't get a day off, were treated harshly. You especially should remember to treat your slaves more kindly than you were treated by making sure they got their day off.
Now, you're saying that by seeing the sort of principle that's at work there, that there's a creational pattern and that it reflects the communal nature, a social nature of the way we live together and work together. You don't work on your own. You live and work and rest with everybody else in your particular social or cultural grouping, that those two aspects that the commandments teach and emphasize, that as we look at them and learn from them as new covenant people, as people who are not under the law of Israel as law, as Paul makes pretty plain at various points, we nevertheless learn from the commandments They teach us something that we should observe and understand and keep in our lives, even though we're not Israelites, we're not national Israel, we're not living under a law code. And yet they teach us. In that sense, you're treating the law there as almost like Torah, as teaching, as something that instructs you about life and the world and how to live as God's people, not as law in the sense of the law of Moses that we're under and have to keep. Would that be a fair way of putting it?
Well, we're certainly not under it in terms of our salvation. That's where the grace element's completely right. And we're not under it in terms of being a government. We're not the nation Israel. We're not even a Christian nation. I'm not sure you can be a Christian nation. But yes, the law does teach us how to live. And how to live is to take a day off each week. And how to be responsible to make sure those who are your dependents, those who are working for you, those who are your servants, that others also share that day off. It's a principle of justice for poor people, because it's the poor people who suffer when they have to work so that I can have a day off. That's really...
So I can have the enjoyment of going down to the shops and browsing and window shopping. Not that I would ever find that enjoyable, but I understand some people do. So that I can go and have convenience and shop and do this and that on that day, then people have to... Who are the people who are behind the counters, and who are the people who are opening the shops, and who are the people who are on security? It's not the bosses.
It's never the bosses. No. The bosses are having a really enjoyable time. Going shopping or not even doing anything, playing their round of golf or some other pastime.
Some other decadent pastime, yes.
But the poor people, the only job they can get involves working on those days. And so it's an unfair, unjust system, because work is social, communal, and rest must be social and communal as well. And the social capital, as they talk of it these days, of our community is found not only in working together, but also in resting together. But if we can't all rest together, then I'm afraid we're undermining our society. We're undermining the very unity of our society, because it undermines families. It undermines the neighbourhood. And it forces poor people to work in unsociable hours, stacking shelves at night. I always feel sad for the people who have to get ready for the Boxing Day sales by spending Christmas Day undoing all the specials and then making new specials and having the shops ready for people. A public holiday is a good thing to have for the sake of the public, and especially for the sake of the poor people who are being forced to work when they don't want to.
Two things occur to me based on what you've just said. The first is that sense that the psalmist gives when he reads the law of the wonderful, rich, good things that come out of your law. Psalm 119, but other psalms as well, where the psalmist meditates on, chews over, thinks about the law, which we don't think is a very edifying activity. It's law. How boring and kind of restrictive is that? But he looks at the law and sees sweetness and goodness in much the kind of way you're describing. The Sabbath law describes something really, really good that's worth embracing. And the more you chew over it and understand it, that it's about the goodness and joy of rest as well as work, and it's about the importance of looking after everyone in your society and culture and community so that you can do that together socially, those are really wonderful things that come out of the law. And so it's this sense that law, as law teaches us, it teaches us the good life. It teaches us the good way to live. It has so much to commend it. And secondly, and kind of related to that, it makes me think that even though I wouldn't regard myself as a strict sort of Lord's Day Sabbatarian, that's not the kind of view I have of how the Sabbath sort of translates into Sunday and so on. And Christians can disagree about that, of course, as I do with good friends who have different views on that. But I think what that kind of Sabbatarianism is driving at is good in its essence. That is, we should keep a day aside as a culture, and we should rest, and we should do that together and mark a day off. And in an earlier time when we were a more Christianized society, setting aside a day like Sunday and saying that's going to be our day, when we shut the shops and we have time off together as a society, was a very good thing.
Yes, we don't need 7-day shopping.
No.
The amount that's going to be bought, the economic change that comes about by owning, having shops running 7 days a week, it's a competitive advantage, not an absolute advantage. The amount of money the shopkeepers make will not change if you do all your shopping on 6 days as opposed to 7 days.
As soon as somebody opens on the seventh day,
then I'm in competition with them.
I have to.
You know, yes.
If I don't open, then they get the custom.
And so the government, this is the kind of area in which government, concerned for the welfare of society, needs to make decisions and make regulations. But yet there's always this pressure from the greedy, from the competitors, from our desire to increase our market share, increase our economic activity, to undermine the social value of having everybody having the same day off so that I can spend time with every member or any member of my family or any and every member of the community. See, this is not a churchman trying to protect Sunday so that church doesn't have competition. It's much more important than that. It's about a community having a day off. It can be a Wednesday, it can be a Friday. See, Romans 14 makes it quite clear. Christians will disagree. One man counts one day more important than another. Another man counts every day. And when you think about the New Testament, when slaves were converted, they couldn't keep the Sabbath day unless their boss gave them the freedom to keep a Sabbath day, whichever day of the week, whether it was a Saturday or the Lord's Day on Sunday. It's not until the community became Christianized, or in the case of Israel,
became a nation.
When they became a nation, that they could make this kind of legislation. But I'm afraid our society is run by secularists who are so keen to destroy family life and so keen to destroy religious life. And our governments are so scared of the secularists, they don't want to appear to be supporting any religion. So they will not have Friday off because that would be supporting Muslims, or Saturday off because that would support the Jews, or Sunday off because that would support the Christians. So we won't have any day off. We just run by the economy and destroy the social fabric and character of our life, especially for poor people. This is an appalling part of our history in Australia and Western society. It's the capitalists who have done what the socialists and communists tried to do.
It's very true. The French Revolution, they tried to bring in a 10-day week, didn't they?
Yes.
That's right, because they were going to get rid of this church-based 7-day. That was a church thing, the 7-day week. We've got to get rid of that. So we're going to have a...
Well, they went for decimal everything.
Yeah, decimal everything. That's right. And
so they created a new calendar, a new series of days of the year. They tried to turn the whole world into a decimal world. And so you work 10 days a week. It only lasted a few years, 15 years or so, but it was miserable the whole time. And then, of course, the Russian communists, Stalin tried in 1929, he brought in the continuous week. And so everybody was given a colour, and depending on your colour, you had a day or two off a week on those days. But there was no weekend for the community. It was everybody had different days off. This meant the machines could keep running all the time. It meant the economy...
You could maximise production and efficiency by minimising the sense of we're people who need to rest, and we need to rest...
Together.
Oh, now I understand why UNSW have gone to trimesters then.
Oh, it's appalling. We'll go to that in a moment. But yes, the communists only lasted 11 years doing this. It was so inhuman. It was so ungodly. It was intentionally aimed at undermining family life and at undermining religious life in Russia. It was explicitly, that was part of the reason for it.
The state is your father.
The state is your father.
We are your family. Yep.
And your religion.
And your religion. And we must break down whatever connections you have with both. And that includes communal connections.
Now, Tony and I have not been graduates of the University of New South Wales or ever Well, I did study there for a little while.
But I studied there for a little while as well. I did one subject there. No, two subjects there as part of my degree. So there you go.
I see. But the University of New South Wales, we've both worked on as Christian workers, etc. And about, I don't know, 5, 10 years ago.
I think it was, it was maybe 6 years ago now.
They brought in a new timing system called trimesters, in which they got out of step with the rest of the community. And it has been an unmitigated disaster. I think it was done because it meant more government money came into that particular university.
Oh, it meant they could maximise the number of students coming through.
Yes.
There were economic reasons and efficiency reasons why they felt it was a great idea.
But it meant the students at that university were out of step with every other students from every other university. So if there were joint university activities like a sporting thing or camp, well, you weren't doing exams at the same time. And you can say, well, that's efficient. You know, we can pay for examiners to move from one campus to another because there's all kinds of efficiencies, but it was inhuman. It was especially inhuman for the staff, the family staff. If you didn't have a family, it didn't matter to you. But if you had a family, your holidays didn't coincide with school holidays. And so you couldn't be going away except at the peak time when you couldn't afford to go away.
Like the Christmas holidays, yeah.
Oh, the Christmas holidays. You see, it was an efficiency that had nothing to do with humanity. And that is a disaster. Well, that's just a microcosm. They've now given up on it. I understand they're trying to unravel that and go back to the same kind of term times of everybody else. But they tell us it's going to take several years to reset the program. I can't understand why. It didn't seem to take several years to go wrong. But they're going to do that. But it's just a microcosm of what our society as a whole is doing. Out of fear of ever being seen as religious, and out of commitment to economic wealth and GDP, they have undermined what is so important for our working lives, that is, that we holiday together. That is what that commandment on the Lord's Day about the Sabbath, that's what it's about. And the great example of Mr. Liddell standing up for principle in his day, in his age, when people understood it, is a wonderful story to hear again and to see again, especially as it's 100 years ago, and it was at Paris where he ran in the Olympics on the day in which he, by conscience, felt free to.
Philip, that almost sounds like a cadence, the way you finished that last sentence. I think it was like we're coming to it. You tied it up in a very nice bow.
Okay, I'm a preacher.
That's right. You can't help yourself. Very nice. You came back to your introduction. Beautifully done. But, of course, there are plenty of other things you might want to think about with respect to Sabbath. And dear listeners, if you do have questions, further questions you want to ask and you want to discuss further, the whole idea of rest and Sabbath and the Christian community and Christian lives and how we apply these things to ourselves, feel free to write in and ask your questions. You can always just hit reply to the email that you get if you're on the Two Ways News email list. And let me encourage you to sign up for that list at twoways.news if you haven't already. It's a great way to keep in touch. Or you can just email me at tonyjpayne, that's tonyjpayne@me.com, and ask away. And we do love getting your comments and questions on all these matters. But there's also an article. I was going to say you could wait for the Ten Commandments book to come out, but that's a little while for you to wait to get more information on this. There is an article, Philip.
Don't miss buying it when it does come out.
That's right, of course. Mm. It's eagerly awaited. But there is an article you wrote on this subject when you were back at the cathedral, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it was a From the Dean article that I wrote on work and rest.
And Sabbath and these kinds of issues. That'll flesh out some of these things as well, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes for this episode. So go and look at that. That'll be on philipjensen.com. The article's called Give Working Families a Rest, but we'll put the details and links to that in the show notes.
Good. How about I pray?
Why don't you do that?
Heavenly Father, we do thank you for government. We thank you for those in authority over us. And we do pray, as we've been taught to pray for those in authority, that they would be caring for the community, that they would not be living for their own success or for the wealth of the community alone, but for the good of the community, especially for those who are vulnerable, those who are weak, those who are poor, And we do pray, Father, that they might make such decisions as to make sure that other people under their authority might live in godliness and peace in this world by having opportunity both for work and to rest and to be able to do so together. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.